This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 128, Chaos on the Western Front. Is that the second time I've used that episode title? I don't actually remember. What I do remember is that last time, I covered the so-called First War of the Diadochoi, or in full English, the First War of the Successors. Despite the common name, which was given in retrospect, the actual successors to the throne, at the time, didn't have much to do with that war. Alexander IV was barely 3 years old when the war ended, and he, his mother Roxane, his uncle King Philip III Aridaeus, and Philip's warrior wife Eurydice were sequestered away with the Macedonian matriarch Olympias in Sardis. In reality, the First War of the Diadochoi was a war for the regency, the true power behind the throne. Antipater came out on top after the death of Perdiccas. Several Perdiccid satraps and regional governors remained at large, but of those, only Eumenes of Cardia, the former secretary and assistant of Alexander the Great, turned satrap, turned rebel warlord, remained a significant threat in eastern Anatolia. Meanwhile, despite his victory, Antipater was old and died shortly after the end of the war. He passed the regency to his friend, Polypherkon, who was another elder Macedonian officer, rather than giving it to Antipater's own son, Cassander. He did name Cassander Chiliarch, second in command of the whole empire, essentially a position to gain experience, and Antipater probably thought he was setting his son up to take the regency in the very likely event that Polypherkon died before Alexander IV reached adulthood. Remember, Polypherkon is already pretty old anyway. But Polypherkon and Antipater were the old guard. Cassander was just a year younger than Alexander the Great himself, and though he did not travel east with the late Lord of all Asia, Cassander did go to join Alexander in Babylon shortly before his death. Cassander had seen the new world ushered in by the late king, an order built on the strength of young warriors that had wiped out or abandoned most of the Macedonian old guard in their father's generation. In response to his father's perceived slight, Cassander plotted a revolt of his own to seize the regency, and he called on Ptolemy, satrap of Egypt, and Antigonus Monophthalmos, satrap of Greater Phrygia and strategos of the East, to join him in fighting Polypharchon. Both men promptly answered the call. Ptolemy had already invaded and occupied most of southern Syria and the Levant in anticipation of more civil wars, taking that territory from the governors legally approved by Antipater at the end of the First War. Antigonus was openly ambitious and seeking to gain more power for himself beyond his satrapy in Phrygia, a goal made manifestly easier by becoming the supreme military commander assigned to hunt down Eumenes. Now that the tables had turned and the two most influential satraps of the empire sided with Cassander, Polypharchon changed tactics and sent the historian Hieronymus, whose works are lost today, to the Cappadocian-Armenian border region. Hieronymus was a personal friend of Eumenes, and Polypharchon offered reconciliation and a return to good standing in exchange for Eumenes' help in the coming war. Eumenes, still stuck inside the fortress of Nora, eagerly accepted that deal. This was, from the start, a war of schemes and plots just as much as battles. Immediately after receiving Cassander's call to arms, Antigonus met with his own advisors and friends in Anatolia, and laid out a plan to use this war to their own benefit. Like Ptolemy, Antigonus realized how the world was changing, and he planned to use Cassander as a rallying point on his own way to the Macedonian throne. According to Diodorus, Aridaeus, Ptolemy's ally who stole Alexander's corpse to bring it to Egypt, caught wind of Antigonus's plan. Aridaeus didn't really mind that the other man was plotting a coup, but after the war with Perdiccas, Aridaeus was made satrap of Hellespontine Phrygia, and he wanted to secure his borders if Antigonus made a move. So Aridaeus gathered his army and assaulted the heavily fortified city of Cuzicus, on the border between Hellespontine and Greater Phrygia. Diodorus describes this force as heavily dependent on mercenaries, but well equipped for a siege. It also marks our first encounter with an odd phenomenon of Hellenistic warfare. The Sicilian historian says that 500 of Aridaeus's 12,000 men were Persian archers and slingers. Now, there are plenty of Persians still spread out all over the empire in the aftermath of Alexander's wars, but Persians also weren't particularly well known for their slingers. Several local Anatolian and Caucasian cultures were, and in Hellenistic records, there is a tendency to describe local levies fighting outside the main Hellenistic phalanx as Persian, regardless of their actual ethnicity. The Cuzicani offered to surrender on the condition that Aridaeus would not subject them to military occupation. Since installing a garrison was the whole point of this exercise, Aridaeus refused. Cuzicus then reached out to their allies in Byzantium and sent ships down the coast to retrieve citizens in the countryside that had been cut off by the siege. Aridaeus made the very basic error of besieging a coastal city without a naval blockade. Before long, Cuzicus had near military parity with the invaders. They sallied out and beat back Aridaeus in a brief skirmish outside the walls. Antigonus then arrived with an even larger army after the battle. But rather than assaulting Cuzicus, he made friends and sent envoys to demand Aridaeus' surrender. Aridaeus fortified his cities and basically said, "Come and make me." knowing that his rival satrap had fewer men who were now more spread out, Antigonus split his army in half, sending 11,000 to invade Hellespontine Phrygia, and taking about 12,000 with him as they marched into Lydia, intending to expel the pro-Polypherkon satrap Cletus from Sardis. Cletus, for his part, made sure that the most important cities of the satrapy were well fortified, and then he bounced. He went to Macedon to warn Polypherkon that Antigonus was on the warpath, and to ask for reinforcements. No sooner was Cletus gone than Antigonus conquered Ephesus, which just so happened to have 4 ships carrying Cilician taxes in its harbor. Naturally, Antigonus seized the silver and used it to hire more mercenaries. However, seizing taxes shifted the tenor of the war. This was no longer just a contest for regency. Stealing taxes was a declaration of war against Alexander IV and Philip III, rebellion against the throne. On the far side of the Aegean, Cassander quickly realized that he had drastically miscalculated. While many of Alexander the Great's most powerful generals were eager to change the world, most Macedonians who had stayed home were not. They were happy to support Polypherkon. Cassander didn't stand a chance in a palace coup, so instead he fled to join Antigonus in Anatolia, which was great news for Antigonus. Cassander could be trusted to take command of the northwestern theater of the war and fight to the death, since he had just committed the highest of treasons. Antigonus was then free to take some of their forces east and seize control of the rest of Alexander the Great's vast Persian Empire, and Cassander loved that because it meant that Antigonus couldn't take power for himself, at least not in Macedon. So Cassander officially declared that Antigonus was now the satrap of Susiana, old Persia's Elam. Between Antigonus's rapid conquests in western Anatolia and Ptolemy's capture of the Levant, Polypherkon found himself entirely cut off from Eumenes and the rest of the empire. He was also getting very worried about the Greek cities so recently defeated in the Lamian War, not because they might resume that conflict, but because all of the oligarchs given power there were loyal to Antipater, and by extension, to his son. So Polypherkon and his generals sent orders to remove the oligarchs and allow Athens and its allies to go back to democratic governance on the condition that they assist the Macedonian kings. This did work, and Polypherkon was able to safely draw troops from the half-subjugated southern Greeks. Down in Athens, the Macedonian officer that had garrisoned the surrounding area since the Lamian War was named Nicanor, and he was desperately trying to convince Athens to side with Cassander, despite the fact that Cassander favored the anti-democracy faction in Athenian government. Instead, they raised the Athenian army and assaulted Nicanor's fort, only for the general to not only repel them, but seize control of the Piraeus, the main Athenian port. Nicanor then received a letter from Queen Mother Olympias, ordering him to stand down. See, immediately after taking power, Polypherkon sent word to Sardis, summoning Olympias to come back to Macedon and care for Alexander IV. But Olympias had already fled to her own homeland in Epirus because she thought Antipater was going to send assassins. Now that everything was changing, Olympias was not just going to sit around. Nicanor was aware that Polypherkon had reached out to the Queen Mother Emeritus and promised to respect her wishes if only to avoid the possibility that Polypherkon would attack Nicanor directly. Unfortunately, Nicanor waited too long and Polypherkon's son arrived with an army, besieging the Piraeus, but they couldn't break the defenses. Instead, they just let the Athenians execute or exile anybody who had previously supported Cassander or Antipater. Polypherkon himself was marching into the Peloponnese, not to face Sparta for a change, but Megalopolis, the capital of the Arcadians, who opted to take Nicanor up on his offer. Megalopolis prepared for a siege and called on all of their citizens, resident aliens, and slaves to help prepare or fight in the militia. When he arrived, Polypherkon undermined the walls, causing a section to collapse as his men charged into the city. But the Megalopolitan army just used this as a funnel to lead Macedonian invaders into Greek spears. Then they started refortifying that section of wall as soon as the Macedonians withdrew. The Megalopolitans also deployed a bunch of fake fortifications. These were set up so that Macedonians would approach them and discover booby traps, including spike pits specifically designed to wound Macedon's recently acquired war elephants. Ultimately, Polypherkon had to abandon Megalopolis and turn his focus elsewhere. Two defeats in a row started to worry Greeks all over the countryside. If Polypherkon couldn't even take two Greek cities, it was starting to look like he might not have the military power to take on Cassander, and they really didn't want to end up on the wrong side of another Macedonian conqueror. Even Athens rethought its position and allowed Cassander to install a tyrant as temporary governor of the city until they could defeat Polypherkon and reassess the Greek situation. Kind of like a Roman dictator around the same time period. With all this newfound Greek support, Cassander was able to land back in Europe, raise an army, and start ousting the Macedonian garrisons around the Peloponnese. Then, in 317 BCE, the situation in Europe changed again in a very unexpected way. With the actual regent and his son busy fighting Cassander in the south, Eumenes off in Mesopotamia, and the three most powerful satraps all in revolt, actual day-to-day governance of Macedon's empire fell to Alexander the Great's niece, Eurydice, and by extension, her king, husband, and uncle, Philip III. Eurydice, famously a rare case of a Macedonian warrior princess, made her play for power. The consort heard that Olympias was finally planning to come back from Epirus and take control of the regency. So Eurydice declared for Cassander and sent a letter inviting him to bring his troops to Pella and seize control of the capital without resistance. Eurydice also marshaled her mother's old regiment of Macedonian troops and marched them to Euea, near the border with Illyria in what is now Croatia. Unfortunately, this mobilization tipped off Polypherkon, who sent troops north with orders to obey Olympias, and the two queens faced off on Macedon's western frontier. We very nearly got our first ancient battle commanded by women on either side, but Olympias' reputation and her custody of the young Alexander IV made Eurydice's men hesitant, and they refused to fight against the old queen. Eurydice tried to escape while the loyalist army marched into Pella themselves and detained Philip Aridaeus as well as their allies at court. Queen Eurydice only made it as far east as Amphipolis, probably intending to join Antigonus's territory when she was captured. Philip and Eurydice were locked in a small room within the royal palace at Pella, and held there for days, on as little food and water as Olympias could be bothered to give them. Then, the old queen ordered a group of Thracian mercenaries to seize King Philip III, her stepson, and stab him to death. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Philip III, born as Prince Aridaeus, was 40 years old, and he had been the co-king of Macedon, including the vast empire conquered by his younger half-brother, for 6 years, before his jealous stepmother decided that Philip had outlived his usefulness. Philip's age and marriage made him a liability in Olympias's eyes. She was determined that her grandson would inherit the kingdom, and she realized that so long as rivals to Alexander IV could form up behind an alternate king, there would always be threats. Eurydice was blamed as the mastermind behind an attempted palace coup, and she was left in the cell with her husband's corpse until Olympias sent a package containing a sword, a noose, and toxic hemlock, with orders from Olympias to choose whichever method of suicide that Eurydice preferred. In one final act of defiance, Eurydice used the sash of her own dress rather than any of the implements provided for her. With the two most threatening royals dead, Olympias ordered a mass purge of the palace, detaining and executing dozens of Cassander's friends and allies to the horror of the survivors, who watched their friends die over a political difference they had never even acted on. That became very inconvenient to Olympias when Cassander arrived the following spring. He had been besieging a city in the Peloponnese when he received Eurydice's letter, and didn't have the ability to just break off his assault immediately. However, he did eventually break it off and sail up to Macedon, bypassing many of Polypharchon and Olympias' forces that had occupied the route between Athens and Pella. Olympias took all of the remaining royal family members, including Alexander IV and his mother Roxane, to the fortress of Pydna. However, on short notice and with sufficient soldiers to try and resist Cassander's impending assault, they simply did not have the food and water inside to withstand a long siege. Olympias called on her cousin, the king of Epirus, to send reinforcements, but Cassander sent a detachment to intercept them on the road, only to discover that most of the Epirote army had already deserted, gone home, and sent their own king into exile in absentia. Cassander's forces quickly captured and executed the condemned king, and allied with the new one against Olympias. Another detachment was sent to deliver bribes and an ambush to Polypherchon's army, breaking up Olympias's last hope for reinforcements, and crushing Polypherchon's ability to fight all at once. Pydna suffered a siege all through that winter, and when spring came again, the defenders and royals inside alike were beginning to starve. Olympias was forced to allow desertions just to ration their food, and when those deserters went over to Cassander, the siege grew stronger. Olympias tried negotiations, and Cassander responded with a simple demand: unconditional surrender. Seeing as it was either that or starvation, the old queen complied, turning herself, the royal family, and most importantly, the 6-year-old king Alexander IV, over to his new regent. Cassander then ordered Olympias to have her subordinates in the other fortresses surrender as well, delivering Macedon into Cassander's hands with barely a battle to speak of. According to Diodorus, the new regent tried to handle the next step gracefully, sending mutual friends of his and Olympias to encourage the queen grandmother to flee into exile rather than remain at court. She refused. Olympias was too influential and too well known for Cassander to allow her to stay. So 200 men were sent to storm her personal palace, capture the mother of Alexander the Great, and murder her in her apartment. Cassander spent the next year chasing Polypherchon across Greece, going from besieged city to besieged city, ousting Polypherchon here, relieving them from Polypherchon's troops there, until finally he had Polypherchon's son trapped in a small Thessalian citadel, and Polypherchon himself in Messenia, on the far side of the Peloponnese. Cassander's army still couldn't break their defenses in either case, but they didn't really need to. For all intents and purposes, they were done, and the last vestiges of resistance couldn't possibly hold out forever. So the regency provided funds to the Macedonian and Greek cities that had come over to his side so they could rebuild their walls and infrastructure damaged in the war. Cassander also went to Boeotia in order to reestablish the city of Thebes, burned to the ground by Alexander the Great 20 years earlier. Rebuilding Thebes would provide a loyal center of power right in the middle of Greece. But while Cassander was busy taking the regency, the war in Asia raged on. So now we skip back 3 years from the end of the fighting in Europe in 515 to 518, so we can check back in with Antigonus and Eumenes. By taking western Anatolia, Antigonus and Cassander had secured valuable shipyards and naval militias from the Anatolian Greeks, which they mobilized under Cassander's command to take the war properly back to Greece. The main Macedonian fleet was still in Macedon, and Polypherchon gave command to Cletus, the former satrap of Lydia. He went straight through the Hellespont and into the Sea of Marmara to attack Antigonus at Byzantium, landing and assaulting beached ships and the surrounding encampment in a surprise attack. It was initially successful, but Antigonus rallied his troops and got their ships out to sea for a naval confrontation, where they overwhelmed Cletus through the sheer number of marines boarding his ships. Cletus attempted to land on the northern shore with a band of survivors to walk back to Macedon through Thrace. That's when another faction entered the war. After years of fighting the Thracian king Soothes, Lysimachus, satrap of Thrace, had brokered a ceasefire, and now turned around to take his army south and join with Cassander. Lysimachid troops captured and executed Cletus and his men somewhere on the southern Thracian coast. While Antigonus was conquering Ionia, Eumenes was in Cappadocia, hardly able to believe his good luck. A year earlier, he was on the verge of falling to an Antigonid siege, but now Antigonus had left him alone, and Polypharchon was offering him a return to power. Eumenes was able to march out of Nora and take control of the pro-Polypharchon armies in the region. He went southwest to rendezvous with his new army in Cilicia, including the vaunted Silver Shields, effectively the new Macedonian equivalent to the Persian Immortals. That's when things got weird. Some of Eumenes' new troops were hesitant to follow the satrap east in pursuit of Antigonus. But Eumenes claimed that the deified Alexander the Great had appeared in a dream and granted Eumenes a blessing that he could not fail in battle. Eumenes had a new royal traveling tent constructed in the style of the Achaemenid kings, both to function as a command center and to become a mobile temple to the divine Alexander. They used this to draw pro-Polypharchon troops in, especially those in southern Syria who wanted to escape from Ptolemy. By spring of 318, Eumenes had 13,000 men at his command. First, they invaded Phoenicia to secure the shipyards and reinforce Polypharchon's fleet after the losses suffered at Byzantium. But Eumenes heard that Antigonus was now pursuing him. Instead of continuing south through the Levant to face Ptolemy, Eumenes took his troops inland and marched across northern Syria to cross the Euphrates River and secure the upper satrapies. So far, the Eastern Empire had mostly stayed out of the wars for the regency, and they could potentially change the tide of battle. So Antigonus pursued his rival inland, leaving Cassander to deal with the West on his own, in the story we just told. Next time, we will follow this second war into the East as Alexander's generals continue to play the game of standing slightly behind the thrones. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.